Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
This is episode 101 of the podcast. I am Dave, your host. I'm on the couch next to Mel. Say hi, Mel. Hi, Mel. That's Mel. Mel is a chihuahua. He's 7 pounds. He's been hanging out with me this weekend. Hey, today on the podcast, Shastri Ethan Nickturn, the author of One City, A Declaration of Interdependence, and the author most recently of The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path. He will be giving a talk about creativity, art, making art, being a creative person, or struggling with being a creative person, whether it be confidence, whether it be making a living. This was a talk that was recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering back in April. Shastri Nickturn will be teaching the introductory weekend meditation program Shambhala Training Level 1 this weekend, July 15th. That's July 15th, 16th, 17th. For more information and to register, click the link on the homepage. Are you going to be there, Mel? Do you want to meditate? No? Are you meditating now? Mel is very chill. He would do excellent in a meditation program. But you know what? You don't have to be chill to meditate. In fact, all mind states are welcome. So without any further ado, by the way, click the link on the homepage, nyshambhala.org, for more information about the program, Shambhala Training Level 1, and all our other great classes and programs. And now, here's Shastri Ethan Nickturn.
Today, I wanted to talk about a very big topic that's actually huge in the Shambhala teachings, huge in my life, and can go in a lot of different directions. So I apologize if anything I say seems overly generalized or simplistic. Because when we're talking about the relationship between either meditation practice or these transformative teachings and creative process, the discussion could go in so many different directions. We could talk about how meditation gives us ideas for being creative. We could talk about being mindful while you're being creative. You know, we could talk about you could talk about how to be a creative person in a world where you also need to make a living. Either and we could go all the way out and actually talk about the way that the founder of our tradition, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, really expressed the purpose of being a creative person, which was to bring about or help bring about the cultural aspect of what was necessary to create an enlightened society. No laughter there. You know, the last time I spoke, I was joined by a meditator who's the New York State Attorney General, who I believe was very busy today handling complaints of voter disenfranchisement, because I was one of those people. So I hope you all, those of you who had the opportunity to vote, used it, because I had to do an affidavit thing and felt what many disenfranchised people throughout history have felt. So we talked about the aspect of enlightened society that has to do with looking at the systems of exchange, the environment, the educational, political systems that we engage in. And you could say that the other aspect of enlightened society is the creative and cultural aspect. So in one of the movies that was made about the founder of our tradition, Chogyam Trungpa, I think it's still on Netflix. It's a pretty cool movie. It was made by one of his students, so it's not really like a unbiased documentary. But how many people bother to make documentaries if they're actually unbiased about a subject? But they interview one of his students who's a member of the New York community named Jack Nyland, who said it very succinctly. He said, if you want to change, Chogyam Trungpa believed that if you want to change a society, you have to change its culture. And if you want to change its culture, you have to change its art. So we could take this conversation, this is the hard part, we could take this conversation from the standpoint of just what is the process of creativity related to the act of mindfulness and awareness as we experience the mind in meditation. We could take this conversation in the direction of right livelihood. How does one make a living either as a creative person, which is where I think the laughter came from, or while being a creative person or identifying as a creative person, which might be feel a little bit more less laughable in this day and age. Or we could really think about the sort of cultural and aesthetic vision that our society holds, and whether that's based on human goodness or confusion. So I'm really interested, just to begin at the beginning, to look at the relationship between the mind that we experience in meditation and the perceptual and expressive act of creativity. So just to bring it back to that personal level of what is the relationship between the mindfulness and awareness and the way we experience our mind when we're doing like the practices we just did, and how that could apply to some creative process. And then maybe when, I don't want to talk too long, maybe in the discussion, I don't know which direction this is going to go in. Maybe we want to talk about art as social transformation. Maybe we want to talk about how do we get a job and be a Buddhist and get paid for making our art. My father teaches a workshop, since he's a lifelong musician, Buddhist, and businessman, called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. So that could be the direction we go in. But I'm really interested in starting the conversation with what is the mind? On the one hand, the mind is a space of receiving experience, of perceiving, right? So how does perception work? It's really interesting question. According to classic Buddhist thought, there are six gateways of perception. Six sort of entry points through which you can receive experience in the present moment. True, real experience. What are those six? Any guesses? The sense perception, so that's classically that's five: sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch. So what would the sixth gateway be? Emotions, okay. Yeah, thoughts or concepts is usually the way it's talked about. So it's not actually the thing about emotions that's interesting, I think, neurologically, is emotions are usually a combination of a physical sensation and a conceptual process happening somewhat simultaneously or in some kind of bundle. Supposedly, the center of the brain that processes emotions is right next to the part of the brain that processes motion, like movement. So it is there's a physical thing going on in emotion, but there's also usually a thought, a concept, a story that kind of glues in there. So these six, right? So this is, on the one hand, you could say, and I think if you look at sort of some of the classical Buddhist creative frameworks, like classical Buddhist poetry, like in the Japanese Zen tradition or something like that. I think you could say that there's a sense of wanting to be as directly connected with the first five as possible. Like that the sixth, the conceptual, is just valid insofar as it directly connects you with the feeling of like, what is it like to see a tree blossoming? Right? Just what is that moment like? What is it like to receive a sensory experience? So, in a sense, I think a lot of Dharma art has the quality of using our awareness to just hone into what's happening in our senses. And that requires some gathering and settling of the mind. Like, are we even aware of what's happening in this room right now? Like, if we were just going to write a short Basho-style Zen poem about the fan, right? Or, that's actually a better one for 2016, the Siri sound. Right? Did you hear it? Yeah, so that's a doorway of perception, right? And I think sometimes it's interesting. You could think about this. I'd invite you to take a moment to think about your favorite creative act. And if you don't identify as a creative person, let's just get over that for a minute. Or if you too identify as a creative person, let's also get over that. And everyone just think about your own favorite creative process. If you're a writer, if you're a painter, if you're a musician, if you're bad at these things, if you're good at these things, just think of how you like to receive and express experience. And just first think about which direct sense experiences, which direct sense gateways does this lead you through? And that sixth one, if, like me, you're a writer, you could say, well, it's really about working with concepts. So you could say that. But just think about which sense perceptions in the creative acts that you like to participate in become prominent in your perception. So obviously, just mindfulness awareness meditation. Did you all hear the honking? Just mindfulness awareness meditation should aid our creative process just because we actually notice what's happening and take time to slow down to notice what's happening. So I think sometimes Dharma art is left there, just at like noticing what's happening and express that. Which would be really interesting because, in a sense, then you'd whatever your experience would be, it would just be very direct, sort of momentary framings of perception, right? You would just your sound, your music practice would all be just like moments of sound that reflect your environment. Your writing would all be moments of perception. Your painting or photography would just be very literal capturings of landscapes. The other thing about the mind that's taught very extensively in Buddhism, which I think we often forget, is not only is the mind receiving constantly, but it's also generating or projecting constantly. Right? So I think sometimes a cliched version of Buddhist creativity only includes the receptive quality. But that's not all that Buddhism is saying about the mind. We are constantly generating. In this room, there are 100 fantasies, at least, happening right now. Don't worry, there won't be a quiz on what is yours. That's up to you. If you're even ready to be honest with yourself about what you're fantasizing about during this. But the mind is generating, right? It's creating something. There's a kind of ping-pong game between perceiving and projecting, perceiving and projecting. So I think sometimes it's nice to start the mindfulness awareness practice of creativity with just focusing on the perception, because it's a little simpler and we often miss it. We often don't create enough time to just be like, what is it like to see the fan blades moving? I know we all thought something more interesting than that was going to happen when we entered this room. But just everybody take a moment in the arena of the creativity that you connect with to have a mundane experience of something that's just perceived, not created, is already here and happening in the present moment. Color, shape, sound, thought. Just perceive. So it's interesting for me, because I am watching the fan, that instantly words, almost instantly words to describe that experience start coming up and sort of take it in a different direction. And this is the projective power of the mind, right? You're receiving and you're creating. You're receiving and expressing all the time internally. So mindful, aware art should express that entire interchange, not just the receptivity. So I think that's an interesting element, that the mindfulness and awareness practices, as we do them, are not about shutting down perception, although they might be about limiting it, like when you work with a lowered gaze. That's so that there's a sort of, the gateway can only carry so many perceptions through it so that you have a chance to stay more present. Right? And it's also not about shutting down the generative qualities of mind, although that can just lead us to be completely away from the present moment. But there could be a few moments before a creative session of actually working with mindfulness, awareness, meditation. You could actually meditate that day. That would be a nice thing to do. But you could also take a moment, you could set up your station. How many people here do your creative practice in a place that has a setup, that's a place to be honored, or with an object? If you're like a writer like me or a graphic designer and your object is your laptop, you could at least put that object in a place, consider that place somehow sacred, right? And take a few moments to actually tune into mindfulness and awareness before you begin the creative act. So that's one part of this, how mindfulness and awareness work with both the perceiving aspect and the projecting aspect of consciousness. Does everybody get how those are both, like, the projective or expressive aspect of consciousness is every bit as much about mindfulness and awareness as the perceptive act? We just focus usually on the perceptive act because we usually jump past that part. We usually go to, like, what do I have to say about the fan before we even heard the fan? So it's good to stop before every creative act. Any creative act that doesn't have enough space preceding it might be derivative of someone else's confusion. The other thing that I think is important that these teachings talk a lot about, and this might be getting into more the cultural connotation, is that the creative process should have intention behind it, right? Now, obviously, if intention is too forced, right? If I read a novel and the person is just telling me what the point of the novel is, or see a piece of art and the literalness of the art is so prominent, right? It's not really going to help to have a forced intention. And I'm not really talking about, like, the artist's statement so much. most artist statements I find, I don't know if you've noticed this in the New York art world the last 10 years, what is the most popular word? Liminal. For some reason, every artist statement has to say liminal. Liminal means the space in between, which is good. That's a very Dharma way of putting it. We call that in Tibetan Buddhism the bardo, space in between. But I don't know if a lot of people, I don't even know if we know what we're saying on a lot of our artist statements. More the intention is that in this tradition, and Chogyam Trungpa said this, and I felt it was really important to quote in the chapter on creativity in my book, Chogyam Trungpa said, the purpose of a work of art is, he said, bodhisattva's intention. And a bodhisattva is a compassionate being on the path to awakening, a being who wants to help others. That this is, if art is going to aid, or creativity is going to aid our awakening, it's going to help us open the sense gates to perceive our own basic goodness and wisdom, and it's going to help others, or at least try to help others through the experience of it. Now, there's a lot of possibilities within that. You can sometimes help others by shocking them a little bit. That's called wrathful compassion. In this tradition, it's considered advanced. Don't just blow up at somebody and say that was wrathful compassion. Start with regular compassion. If you're like, yeah, I yelled at this dude today. I made a very violent poem, shouted it into the microphone, but I woke those people up, damn it. That's not quite what we're talking about with wrathful compassion. But it doesn't mean that creativity can't be shocking or outside the box, but it means that the artist should actually have that intention as they identify with a work of creative expression. I think you could actually have a beginning, middle, and end to a creative session, which is really hard for me to remember, especially when I have a deadline. The rough draft of my next book is due September 1st, which is good. I like having a deadline. It's like you reality has boundaries. Time doesn't really exist from an ultimate standpoint, but like from a contractual standpoint, it does. And that's actually a helpful thing. but to actually think about having your creative practice have a sessioned quality, the same way a meditation practice or a yoga practice has a sessioned quality. And you could actually think of stopping, creating space to actually feel or see or hear the fan blades, then to actually remember your intention. Why am I doing this? Am I doing this to harm people? Am I doing this to escape myself? Or am I doing this to awaken and benefit others? And then you can stumble. Just this is for me, writing, which is my main, I've identified as a writer since before I identified as a Buddhist. So my writing sessions are stumbling, chaotic, coffee refills, need to take a walk around the block, a walk around the desk, just like a meditation session in a way. I don't take a walk around the block, but in longer meditation sessions, we do walking meditation. But then I try to have an actual close. So some of the practice sessions in our tradition, one actually closes. And you can do this with any practice session by what's called dedicating the merit of practice. How many people do this as part of your regular practice, the dedication of merit? Does anyone want to explain just the general sense of what dedicating the merit? Jess, do you want to maybe explain? Can you? I know this is going to be a good explanation, so if you can wait for the mic. I already know it's going to be a good explanation, so no, there is no pressure.
Do you want me to actually say the dedication of the merit in addition or no?
Sure. You'd have to explain what the Rigdon is if you wanted to do that.
Oh, I was thinking of the old one, which is maybe easier.
Okay.
Okay.
Sure.
So I think, and Ethan can correct me, that the dedication of the merit, when we practice, we don't just practice for ourselves, but we practice for the benefit of all beings. So saying the dedication of the merit at the end of your practice is a way to, as it sounds like, dedicate the merit of your practice to all sentient beings, and I guess in Shambhala also maybe your intention of creating enlightened society.
That's right, yeah.
So the old dedication of the merit that we don't use as much in Shambhala, but I think is less...
We do it.
Maybe complicated, because it doesn't have the Rigdon and everything.
It doesn't have a Tibetan word in
yeah,
it.
Yeah. is by this merit, may all obtain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all being.
Right. So there is a Sanskrit word.
Yeah,
in there.
I was like, oh, samsara. Oh.
Yeah. So the dedication of merit, the Shambhala four lines, it's always a short little chant. So it brings you into some connection with other people who are practicing, because it's not a chant you invented, although you could do a freestyle dedication of merit. So the Shambhala chant is by the confidence of the golden sun and the great east. Golden sun is a very central symbol in Shambhala that has the feeling of always proclaiming the beginning of possibility, like that it's the morning. It's not we don't take this cynical view that the good times are ending. There's a notion that possibility is always rising. By the confidence of the golden sun, the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. So the Rigdon is that being, not really a human being. It's an androgynous archetype. It's a form of an awakened being, a Buddha. That's the central figure in the Shambhala tradition. And the Rigdons were supposedly the queens and kings of Shambhala, which was a Central Asian myth of an enlightened society, like a lost city of Atlantis-style myth. So you're saying, may that mission of awake in the world bloom or blossom. By the confidence of the golden sun and the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. That's a great intention for creativity, right? So that's a way you could know if wrathful compassion in shocking creative acts was actually such. Is does this dispel ignorance? Does this just celebrate ignorance? There's a lot of art going around in this postmodern era that looks like it just kind of swirls the ignorance around, and you're like, I thought you were going to dispel, but you just kind of swirled it a couple times. Really creatively. But that's not quite where we're getting with this, right? May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory, right? So there's some celebration, something about the creative act that actually brings a sense of glory to being sense perceptions, which doesn't mean it has to be like super colorful or bright, cheerful music, or there's other ways to bring about glory, right? But so there's some proclamation in that at the close of a meditation session or the close of a meeting, we do that, or the close of a creative session, one could do that, of like, may this uplift something, right? May it be of benefit. So the other thing about that, and I loved your explanation, thank you, is that you're acknowledging that the effort of the session was meritorious. You're acknowledging your own merit and then offering it, not forcing it down the throats of others, but offering it to others. So I think it's a great way to end a creative session. So that's what I would say is, if you wanted to try this, to actually structure a session of creativity the same way a person might structure a very loose, chaotic, because there has to be space for both perception and projection to occur, like a very loose, chaotic, but loving meditation session with a beginning, middle, and end. I think that could be a very interesting experience. So I've asked a lot of people recently who are also meditators about the relationship between meditation and their creative process. So a couple people who are both actually Zen meditators, I just want to share what they said. One is one of my favorite, she's also a filmmaker, but she's one of my favorite novelists, and she's a Zen teacher as well. Her name's Ruth Ozeki. She wrote several novels, but she wrote a novel called A Tale for the Time Being, which is basically if Holden Caulfield was reincarnated as a funny Japanese girl. So she's a great practitioner. She teaches Zen. So I asked her, like, what's the relationship between writing and meditation for you? And she said, well, I do both every day. Very Zen answer. And the other was my friend Ross Bleckner, who's a painter. And I asked him about the relationship between meditation and his painting, his creative acts. And he emailed me back a James Michener quote as his answer, who he called a Zen. He didn't tell me who the quote was by. He just said, the Zen master said this. And then I had to look it up, and it was James Michener. The master in the art of living makes little distinction between his work and his play, his labor and his leisure, his mind and his body, his education and his recreation, his love and his religion. He hardly knows which is which. He simply pursues his vision of excellence at whatever he does, leaving others to decide whether he is working or playing. To him, he is always doing both. So that's a nice awake in the world, which these teachings are always about discipline in meditation, but it's always about slowly dissolving the boundaries between meditation and the post-meditation experience, or meditation and everything else. So those are my thoughts on the subject of meditation and creativity. I hope something in there, even if it was vague brushstrokes, was helpful. Thinking about your creative practice as a well-intentioned, chaotic session where intention, a little bit of practice, a lot of chaos, and then a dedication of merit closes it, that's been very helpful to me. So that's the one thing I'd offer as practical advice, if it's helpful to you. But there's a lot of creative practitioners in this room, so maybe other people have advice, questions, comments, insights. We have 20 or so minutes before the tea and cookies and cheese portion of the evening. So, thoughts?
So I had a thought when you were talking. So initially I thought, oh my goodness, art, I am not creative. I'm in the business world. I have zero connection to art. Holy moly. And then you spoke about intention. And I actually started thinking kind of the opposite. Like I thought, well, when I meditate, sometimes creative ideas come to me.
Yeah.
And so creativity doesn't have to be just, you know, kind of like art. Right? It could be like an idea. It could be like, who thought of Trader Joe's, right? Or Whole Foods, right? Yeah. Or like, you know, making a building or, you know, so actually I think sometimes when you don't have an intention, you can actually be your most creative.
Yeah, yeah. So the thank you so much. And that, so the intention is towards the notion of benefiting, right? The intention is not like I need to define this act in a box, right? Because that's not that creative in a way. So there does need to be space for perception, because that's the space into which a new experience or a new idea will flow. It's like actually that's the problem, is we haven't actually seen the fan blades moving. So anything we experience is going to be based on previous.
Yeah.
So something new and perceptual can actually enter, and then that can lead to, it can lead to a painting, it can lead to a new grocery store, it can lead to a building. Yeah. Architecture is interesting because among the creative arts, it's considered, I think sort of cooking is in this category too. It's the ones that are considered the most hybrid of artistic and functional, you know? So, but every art is a hybrid of functional and just enjoyment or awakening something. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. I just wanted to thank you for sharing that dedication of merit.
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking a lot about the role that an artist has. And the way to motivate myself is by thinking that as artists, we have a big responsibility. I'm an actress. Mm-hmm. And I think that in this society, especially right now, there's a lot of getting away from each other, from one another, and not communicating.
Yeah.
And as artists, we have a big responsibility to share our gifts with the world and to maybe awaken certain emotions in people, mm-hmm. to stir something up, to give them epiphanies. Mm. And so it's not only our own self, our own creative expression. We are in tune with everybody, and we're part of a society that needs that so desperately, I think, especially right now.
Yeah.
So I think it's very important for me to think about that.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. What's your name?
Gabriella.
Gabriella, very nice to meet you. Yeah.
The only thing is, I don't think you can give someone an epiphany. I think you can offer an epiphany you had, and there's some magic that it may resonate with someone. But yeah, yeah, yeah. If you're, what I see happening a lot in the world right now, especially the world of narrative arts, but other visual arts, music, is I do feel like something about where our society is spiritually and psychologically, we understand confusion like pretty well. Like, I would actually put stand-up comedy in this arena too. Like, a lot of stand-up comics understand the narration of their own confusion so beautifully. But from a dharmic standpoint, from an enlightened standpoint, we don't only long to understand confusion, we also long to see some journey towards the transcendence of confusion. So I think it's a good beginning, but you know, like, I think about something like Seinfeld, to take a classic example. Just sell it, and it's been, I think this genre has been sort of copied in a lot of different times. Like, I actually think the show Girls is the sort of Brooklyn millennial female heir to the Seinfeld throne, in a way, maybe with even better writing. But I see the celebration of neurosis without the transcendence of neurosis, and that feels limited, because people start to get very subtly cynical that they could have a shift in awareness. And, you know, I talk to friends who work in painting or music, and there's some similar quality of, like, we need to have people who are very acutely nuanced, aware of confusion, but also to have that sense of portraying something that also is taking a step out of confusion is very hard. And I think the problem is that the world in some ways is so cynical that it would just be viewed as cheesy. So anyway, I do agree that this intention, that the responsibility is the place to start. You know, Chogyam Trungpa said so often to his students, he wasn't necessarily talking about art, but he did. He wrote a book called True Perception, which is actually a really great book. And in various points, he basically said, if you try to help other people before you understand yourself, you're just creating more garbage for the world. It's kind of harsh, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think the flip side of that argument is if you try to work on yourself without caring about other people as well, you're just going to create a new narcissism called Dharma or something like that. But I think there's a lot of truth to the idea that, let's put it this way, creative people should be invested in their own mental and physical health. That's the way I'll say it. Because that's health is what we actually want to transmit, even if the path there is a really interesting journey from unhealth to health. Anyway.
Thank you so much for that. Is this on? Since you mentioned it and we all responded so strongly, I wondered if you could talk about making a living from your art.
Whatever thoughts you have on that.
Thanks.
Yeah. I don't know how to do that. The gentleman sitting in front of you is a very talented electronic musician, so you could ask him. He makes a living from his art. Kodomo, while we're giving shout-outs. I know how to do a quarter of that. So I know my friends who live in Europe, it's much easier. That's one of the things. One of the various things about democratic socialism. It's easier to make a living as an artist. More government support. I think there used to be more government support in the U.S. But I think it's actually a good challenge because. The thing that's really helpful about making a living from creative process is you're not just invested in what you're doing. I want to express this. You're also actually invested in how it comes across. So I remember, like, I wrote this bad novel in college, which is kind of cool that, you know, I was working on it. It was hard work, but it was bad. And one of the reasons it was bad was because the beginning was not super engaging. And I remember seeing, like, all these young novelists were getting published. And there's one basic rule of a first novel. It has to be engaging at the beginning. Why is this a rule? Can anybody know why it's a rule? Because who are you going to send this to? You're going to send it to an agent, or you're going to send it to an editor, a publisher. They don't have a lot of time to read. If something doesn't grab them off the bat, they're not going to want to work with you. They're not going to want to give you a contract. They're not going to want to write you a check, which puts money from their account into your account, which makes your landlord let you stay in that place. So I remember feeling like that's so limiting. That's such a sellout to just write a piece of work, you know, that's good at the beginning. Like, what if it gets good 50 pages in? Like, it's my art, you know? And so that's the really humbling good thing about making a living is you start to care about the audience and how something is valuable to an audience. You know, I think there's some things about our creative world that, in terms of the sort of structures of power in our world, if you only need to impress the right four people and you're set, that's the hard part about making a living as an artist in our system is the few people who have done that can really make a living, and then other people really have to struggle. So I do like working in a creative field where I only make a living if a lot of people connect with what I'm doing. That feels very honest to me rather than like I found the right three patrons. If you can find those three patrons, do it and dedicate the merit. Dedicate the merit. I think if the first, I mean, the first response has to be to work within the system we live in. So if we can think about making a living as actually becoming a student of what is valued and how to make a link, which is probably a compromise on both sides between what we're doing and what the audience is willing to see or receive or hear, then that could be really, it's a good practice because it's a practice of communication, you know? So then my first book that was published, which was published by a small publisher, didn't get paid, but I got paid. I didn't get paid enough to make my landlord happy, but, you know, for like a couple months out of the year, he was happy. And then I had to do other things for the other 10 months. But I remember reading through the what I had written with a friend, and my friend said, chapter 3 is really grabbing. It's really, and I was like, oh, well, that's got to become chapter 1 then. And it got published. So, and people like that book, and they've said it's helpful. And I don't have to feel, I've found the middle path between being a sellout and not being a sellout, which is kind of where reality happens. So, I'm sure a lot of people in the room have any other thoughts on the right livelihood piece of creativity? Sir? And I know we have one other comment here. I just wanted to continue this thread for a minute.
Hey, thanks for speaking, and glad to be here. I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know we would be talking about writing and the process of writing, and a couple things came up, random thoughts in my head. One is I actually just read the Ruth Ozeki book that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And the main character being now.
Right.
The livelihood part, and when you said I identify as a writer, I hate saying that I'm a writer.
Yeah.
But I am. And I've made a living at it just about all my life, and it's not a great living, but the livelihood parts, I feel like I have six streams or six types of writing.
Mm.
And I'm always exercising all six streams every day, two or three times a day. And one or two of the streams makes money.
Mm.
And two or three of the other streams don't make money. And then the streams that don't make money make money. And then the streams that were making money stop making money. But I have to have poetry, fiction, nonfiction, journalism, all working, playwriting, always working at the same time. But that's how I operate. And you were talking about your process. I used to have like a very 2,000 words a day Hemingway process. And then now my process is I feel like I sit down and I take off my clothes and then my skin and then turn everything inside out and start to pick off the little black pieces of gunk that are on the inside, and I pull them out and they land on the page. And then
so that could all be part of the chaotic middle.
Yeah,
I was talking about. So set your intention first, dedicated the merit after that, but the middle can look
exactly
like what you said.
Well, the merit is the sort of, I like that you use that word. It's sort of like after I get enough gunk off of me, I feel like I resolved something and I can get up and walk away.
Yeah.
Until 2 hours later, 4 hours later, when I have to do that process again.
So the gunk just comes back?
The gunk is always there, or I wouldn't, or I'd stop writing. That's my process.
Yeah.
If I didn't have the gunk, I wouldn't be writing. But I do it as a livelihood. And, you know, in graduate school, they used to call us liars who were fiction majors, you know. And in journalism, I know how to hit deadlines. But the thing about writing that's interesting that you brought up is unless I'm really interested and love grammar and words and syntax, it's really going to be a horrible experience, you know, and that's something that I love is the actual because that's all I'm working with is words.
Yeah.
And anyway, you also reminded me of the Romantic poets who were my first love, and reading them had really got me into writing. So
yeah.
Anyway, that's I don't have any questions, but you brought up a lot.
Thank you. And what's your name?
Kevin.
Kevin, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. I loved what you said towards the end, that unless you're really interested, there's a gentleman over here who had his hand up before. Unless you're really interested, it's not going to go anywhere. And I think that's also key to meditation practice, that unless you're really interested in being a human being and exploring your chaotic mind, you're going to quit. Because it's not going to be like, oh, I saw that picture where bliss. That's not the problem with bliss is the blissful person in those few moments were usually disinterested in the present moment. And the entire act of meditation from the standpoint of this tradition is getting more interested in the present moment. Not in a fixated way, but really seeing the fan blade. That's my Netflix for, you know. You could make yourself some, I put this line into my next book because it's about, partially about love of a movie. My next book is called The Dharma of the Princess Bride. And in the introduction, I put in the line that we should probably all eat popcorn while we meditate because the mind is like history's greatest movie theater. And if you expect it to be not a movie theater, you're going to quit quickly. So the interest part is what I really, and you have your own metaphors for that, which sound a little intense but beautiful. But the interest part is really important, I think. Sir.
Hi, thank you. Could you say a little more about Trungpa Rinpoche's views of the role of art toward building an enlightened society?
Sure.
And also, is there any specific, among his numerous writings, a specific place where you mentioned the True
Perception is the book that's, it used to be called Dharma Art, and then it was republished under the title True Perception. So that's a great way to hear his take on it. And I honestly think he was considered a Buddhist master, but people have their orientations. I would say Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche, his sort of orientation as a Buddhist teacher is he's kind of a social philosopher. That's sort of like if he had a different job, he would be a philosopher. Whereas Chogyam Trungpa, if he had a different job, he would be an artist. That's kind of the main way to understand his writing, the main way to understand his mind. I think that's also why, David Bowie came and studied with him in the 1960s. Allen Ginsberg was one of his closest students. Joni Mitchell, he really attracted my father, my mother, both artists. But that book, I think, is really great. And he did emphasize a lot. One of the things I've had a hard time with is he did a few things related to narrative art, but he did quite a lot related to intention and not having a self-absorbed intention with one's art. And he did a lot with the five sense gates. He didn't teach a lot about how to write a screenplay, or a narrative structure from a Buddhist standpoint. Although he did, I think he tried to write one or two plays and things like that just in his tour of the phenomenal world, which is kind of what his life was like. A tour of reality, in a sense, and he was interested in everything. But I would really read that book, and to me, the importance of not a self-absorbed intention and the importance of really connecting with the direct nature of phenomenon were two of the kind of dominant themes of what he talked. Very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. Thank you.
One more. Okay, we're getting to, this will be the last one because we're getting towards the tea and cheese portion of the evening.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you just were talking about the self-absorbed intention, the ego or ambition, because there's that aspect of, in narrative, I'm a writer also, this idea that you have to go in if you're working on something long with a goal.
Right.
But then the farther I go in my writing process, trying to write every day, I feel like you have to let go of mm-hmm. what comes out of you.
Right.
So, like, negotiating that tension.
Yeah. The way I understand this from a Buddhist framework is the relationship between ultimate and relative. So the basic canvas of awareness is completely aimless. You know, it doesn't have to be any particular way. A story doesn't have to be told any particular way. A work of art doesn't have to go any particular way, right? So that's the kind of space, and I think this is what Lisa was describing, that in that space you can be like, I'm going to create a grocery store, you know, because just a bunch of bananas pops into your mind and then that creates a whole world, right? So you have to be able to go into that real open canvas space, which formless meditation is really about that. And then I think the relative level is really understanding the structures, like what are the languages that have already been developed in this area? What am I trying to express as, right? Because once you have the grocery store, it has to have boundaries. You have to figure out what you're going to carry, so what you're going to distribute, right? Same thing as writing a book, right? There's a structure. The book has to have parts, themes, introduction. If you want to get anything published, you're probably going to need a proposal, which is like knowing the entire structure of a book before you write it, which is a really weird, interesting process because you basically do the thing you're going to do before you do the thing. But that's actually the interesting. So there's this arising of awareness, and then maybe something comes to mind, and then you fill in the structures. But I think your mind has to kind of toggle back and forth between open awareness and precise structure of thought. And I think part of what meditation practice is for me is knowing when I'm getting a little too aimless or knowing when I'm getting a little too boxed in, and to actually, it's almost like setting the dimmer switch back towards, let's just have space. Let's just hear the fan for a half hour. Open my mind. And then a new structure will emerge, or an articulation of the structure will emerge. And sometimes it's like, no, I really need to, I'm 2 + 2 = 5 in this part of what I'm doing, and that's not my point. If you're trying to make the point that 2 + 2 = 5, that's great, but that's not really reality, right? So we have to kind of toggle back and forth between those two. So I think the intention is about benefiting. It's not about limiting the creative process. I don't know if that's helpful. Yeah. But it is a really interesting process to have to create an entire outline of what you're going to do before you do it, because that's another moment that feels like selling out to the true artist. And if you can figure out what you're going to do and then open back up and reassess, I think that's a great toggling back and forth between relative and ultimate, form and formlessness, precision and openness. Okay. Thank you all so much. I'll be around for a few minutes if anyone wants to talk. There is one chapter in The Road Home that's about this in the last section of the book, if anybody has that book and wants to check that out, because you may have only read the first chapter and then given up on it. So if you want to push ahead to the second to last chapter, it's there. Have a great night. Create something.
Thanks for listening. What'd you think, Mel? What'd you think of the talk, Mel? Yeah, Mel liked to talk. Mel is a little Dharma Chihuahua master. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you happen to live in the New York City area, you can hear these talks in person every Tuesday night at our weekly Dharma gathering. Come check us out. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. your questions, comments, suggestions, dog anecdotes, whatever you like. And take care. Later.